In the early morning hours, a truck driver making his way along State Highway 341 in Sumter County, South Carolina, stopped to rest. On a desolate dirt road near Interstate 95, he made the grisly discovery of two bodies, each having been shot multiple times. By the time the sun came up, the road was blocked off and crawling with investigators. The victims, appearing to be in their late teens or early 20s, had been shot three times each at near point-blank range with a .357 revolver. For police, identifying the killer became the most prominent goal, but they had no way of knowing that more than 40 years later, it would be the identities of the victims that would be the more complex riddle. There were plenty of clues about their origin, but nothing which could unwrap the mystery of their identities. Months later, when police came across the murder weapon and its owner during a routine traffic stop, they assumed the case would be broken. They had no idea that not only would their killer prove elusive, but their victims would remain unidentified beneath a slew of evidence pointing to the four corners of the United States and the world beyond. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 118, The Sumter County Does. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine a mysterious double homicide in which the killer and the victims remain unidentified. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. An unknown assailant brutally murdered two yet unidentified victims in Sumter County, South Carolina. 44 years later, the mystery of this case remains unsolved. This is Episode 118, The Sumter County Does. Today, northeastern Sumter County, South Carolina, is a dense green patchwork of farmland marbled by a network of one-lane dirt roads. These roads intertwine and connect secluded areas before eventually guiding drivers out of the open skies into paved roadways leading towards busier cities. Everything changes, but in some cases, the more they change, the more they stay the same. And the farmland and open fields of Sumter County, if not more constrained today, were certainly more vast and expansive back in the summer of 1976, and much more isolated as well. On Monday, August 9th, 1976, Martin Durant was working, as he did most days of the week, driving his truck hauling merchandise from one end of the state to the other and everywhere in between. It was set to be another hot South Carolina day with highs in the 90s, but with the sun not yet rising, Durant was enjoying the cool morning breeze as it swept in through the windows of his truck. Unlike today, there weren't nearly as many restrictions on how a trucker operated, and Durant was used to working long, hard hours on the road. This morning, though, just after 6 a.m., he found himself rolling down State Highway 341 when he decided to pull over and rest for a while. Light was just breaking on the horizon, not quite enough to fully illuminate the area, though. Durant found himself at Locklear Road, a narrow dirt road, to use the word loosely, which runs parallel to I-95 and connects to 341, just a short distance from the Florence County line to the east. The road ran several hundred yards before hitting high fences, and there was a small tobacco barn in the area. At approximately 6:20 a.m., Durant saw the shape of two figures lying on the side of the road. Unsure of what he was seeing, he began approaching. As the morning light was growing, the sun would be fully up in 15 minutes, but at that point, Durant had seen enough to realize that the two figures were those of a man and a woman, and both were dead. Frightened and caught off guard, Durant ran back to his truck, at which time he contacted Charles Graham, an employee at a local store Durant had frequented. Being that it was 1976, obviously no one had a cell phone, and you're not going to find a payphone along such an isolated stretch of road, but Durant almost certainly had a CB radio. Why he didn't directly contact authorities has been the source of some debate, with some believing he was too freaked out, or maybe he was indulging in activities in that area that weren't necessarily legal. Either way, it's Charles Graham who made the call and notified the Sumter County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff's deputies arrived on a bizarre and confusing scene. The two victims appeared to be younger in age, originally believed to be between 18 and 25. The male victim was approximately 6 feet tall, weighed 155 pounds, and had shoulder-length brown hair, brown eyes, and what has been described as an olive complexion. When found, the male was lying on his back, his right leg bent at the knee and crossed in a figure four shape, with his left ankle on top of his right. His right arm was bent at the elbow and laid across his stomach, while his left arm extended out at a slight angle away from his body. His head was cocked to the left, his eyeline running towards the female victim, who was lying just a few feet away. The female victim was believed to have been younger than the male, presumed at the scene to be between 16 and 23. She had shoulder-length, reddish-brown hair and hazel eyes, and stood approximately 5 feet inches tall, weighing 100 pounds, and also with an olive complexion. She was found lying on her back, legs slightly parted, with her feet jutting just off the edge of the road and into the main dirt path. Her left arm was bent at the elbow and sticking out to her left. Her right arm was curled up with the fingers of her right hand splayed open just behind her head, which was facing left, chin up, tilted, eyes fixed in a blank stare. Neither victim had any identification. Both had been shot multiple times. Autopsies conducted at the Medical University of South Carolina at Charleston would later determine gunshots had been the cause of death, with each victim sustaining 3 blasts from a .357 Magnum revolver. Each victim had been shot twice in the chest and once in the throat, mirroring one another. The autopsy reported that the shots had been fired from no more than a few feet away. It seemed clear early on that the two victims had been executed, and while finding their assailant became the most prominent goal for investigators, they had no way of knowing that identifying their victims would truly become the enduring mystery. Initially, investigators theorized that the killer had likely driven the two victims down the road with the intention to kill them and leave them in a wooded area. However, there were high fences in place at the time which blocked his ability to get beyond the dirt road, and so it was thought that he likely made the choice to shoot them on the side of the road instead. At the time, the Sumter County Sheriff's Office was led by Sheriff I. Bird Parnell, who had been sheriff of Sumter County for 25 years at the time. When speaking with the Greenville News, Parnell explained that the examination of the scene indicated that the killer had driven several hundred yards down the road, forced the two victims out of the vehicle and shot them, before pulling his vehicle into another road leading towards a tobacco hut, backing out and fleeing the scene at a high rate of speed. While the scene itself didn't offer a ton of clues beyond that, at least in terms of the killer's identity, there were actually a lot of details about the two victims which authorities hoped would aid them in their identification. The male victim was wearing faded blue Levi's jeans and a red t-shirt which had Coors American Light Beer printed on the front. While that isn't too specific, the back of his shirt offered a more intriguing clue, reading Camel Challenger GT Sebring 75. His shirt appears to have originated from the Sebring International Raceway in Florida, where annual races are held on what was once Hendricks Army Airfield. For the record, Sebring is approximately 520 miles away from where the victims were found. This connection made authorities wonder if it was possible that the victims could have either been from Florida or could have traveled there, though it remains unknown whether the shirt actually belonged to the victim firsthand or if he had purchased it or maybe it had been given to him. Either way, it was a clue, and interestingly enough, Florida will come up in this case again. Beyond his clothing, the male victim also had a watch and a ring, The watch, a Bulova brand Accutron with the serial number H918803, had a Twistoflex band. According to the Doe Network, while investigators tried to track down documents related to where the watch had been sold, Bulova had destroyed much of its documentation in prior years due to cutbacks. They were, however, able to determine that the watch had been manufactured in 1968. While the watch didn't help much in trying to identify the victim, his ring offered a bigger clue. It was a 14-karat gold band with a gray stone, and engraved on the inside were the initials JPF. Those initials will come into play later when authorities are contacted by a man who claims to have known the victims for a short time. The woman's clothing was less distinctive and has been described as the following. Cut-off Daisy Duke blue jean shorts, a pink halter top that tied in the front, much like a bikini top, over which she wore an unbleached white muslin blouse, which at the time she was found was unbuttoned. She also wore a pair of wedge-heeled sandals, lavender and pink with purple straps. The brand was determined to be Stride Rite. The male victim did not have shoes when he was found. I should also note, neither victim was wearing underwear, and the female victim reportedly had not shaved her legs, though whether we're talking about a few days' growth or more is not specified. While her clothing wasn't helpful, she did have several pieces of jewelry which investigators believed were distinctive. She wore three silver rings, which were described as appearing to be of Mexican or Native American origin. It's been stated that they were handmade sterling silver. One band was faceted with red, white, and blue stones. Another held an oblong black stone, and the last was a large, intricate feather scroll band with jade inlaid in the curves of the scroll. During the writing of this episode, I consulted with Christy Groves, who is known on Twitter as the Doe Patrol, and she has done extensive work researching the two victims. In terms of the jewelry, she explained that they consider it extremely likely that the women's jewelry originated in either New Mexico or Arizona. So far, if the items and clothing were purchased firsthand, that takes our victims through several different states: South Carolina, Florida, New Mexico, and Arizona. However, the trail investigators follow will continue to expand. There was another item subsequently found, though the details surrounding it are a little confusing. The male victim possessed a matchbook, which, depending on where you look, was either found in his jeans pocket or lying right near him. The branding for the matchbook was for Grant's Truck Stop. In 1976, Grant's reportedly only had locations in three cities, these specifically being York, Nebraska, Boise, Idaho, and Lupton, Arizona, according to the High Point Enterprise. I've subsequently found bloggers who have mentioned there also being locations in New Mexico at the time. While the matchbook didn't answer any questions specifically, it added to a theory developed by investigators that the two victims had likely been traveling the country, either in their own vehicle, which was missing, or by hitchhiking. Since it seemed that the victims had likely been traveling, and at least one of them had probably been in the Midwest at some point, police began to consider the possibility that the victims could have been picked up hitchhiking, at which point the person who picked them up may have driven them to this isolated area and killed them, or perhaps they had been carjacked and murdered by the thief. The more police dug into things, the more confusing it seemed to become. And while in many instances Doe cases have very little evidence, this was a case where authorities actually had a decent amount to work with, though that may only have added to their frustrations. Autopsies conducted on each victim revealed a few more details which they thought might aid with identification. Firstly, both victims were described as clean-cut, suggesting that had they been traveling, they hadn't been homeless or without the ability to shower and keep up their hygiene. There were no traces of alcohol or drugs in their system, not even signs that either of them had been a smoker. While no money was found, their stomach contents showed that they had either eaten fruit, ice cream, or a combination of the two shortly before their deaths, and it was believed that this had been purchased in a store. A witness later came forward and claimed to have seen the two victims at a fruit stand in Florence, not far from where they were found. The witness, though, was unable to report any details beyond seeing them and couldn't even remember if they were alone or had their own vehicle. So, Whether they had money, which was taken by their killer or not, is unknown. In terms of the physical examination, the coroner reported that the female victim showed no signs of ever having surgery nor having been pregnant at any time. She had 4 moles, 2 on her left cheek an inch or so away from the corner of her mouth, and 1 on her right cheek. A 4th mole was found behind her right calf. She also had pierced ears. A dental examination showed that she had had some work done. The upper and lower wisdom teeth on her right side were gone, though the left still had them. Her back teeth had fillings, and her teeth were described as being straight. One other detail I might note is that the coroner described the female victim's eyelashes as being longer than usual. On the contrary, the male victim had more extensive physical traits. Firstly, there was a scar from an apparent appendectomy, which ran 4 inches on his lower right side. In addition, there were scars on his back and shoulders, including a 2-inch scar on his right shoulder from previous injuries, possibly suggesting that he had been involved in a physical sport, such as hockey, football, or lacrosse. While these scars can't tell much of a story, his dental records do. The dental work has been described as elaborate, with there being crowns and bridge work. His left front tooth was crowned, most of his upper teeth had fillings, and his wisdom teeth had been removed. There were also several teeth missing in the top and bottom, though most notably in the bottom left of his jaw. Interestingly, Dr. Charles B. Hanna, a forensic dentist, did extensive examinations of the male victim and came to several conclusions. Firstly, noting that the removal of the wisdom teeth likely suggested the victim was older than they thought he was. Hanna theorized the victim could have been as old as 27, telling the Index Journal, quote, "Those teeth don't even come in until about age 18, and they were not recent extractions," end quote. In addition to this, Hanna detected a material in one of the victim's fillings described as radio-opaque base, which at the time had only been on the market for 2 years. Perhaps the most intriguing dental clue came in the form of a very particular type of root canal the victim had done. Dr. Hanna described it as a fluted root canal and stated that the dentist who had performed the procedure would likely have been very skilled, referring to him as a craftsman. He went so far as to suggest that this particular dentist may have specialized in root canals. The particular instruments used in a fluted root canal were not adopted and standardized by the American Dental Association until 1976, leading to a belief that the work had to have been done recently. However, the flute design had been used for years prior. In fact, in 1976, the ADA standardized the materials from which the flutes would be manufactured, not the practice and procedure itself, according to a June 1982 article in the Journal of Endodontics. In a bizarre turn of events, despite their importance, the male victim's teeth were actually donated to a dental school and have since been destroyed. So when it was all laid out, investigators had a large amount of very unspecific information to work with. Essentially, generic clothing, jewelry which was handmade and couldn't be directly tracked, a watch manufactured nearly 10 years earlier, and scars and dental work. Investigators theorized that the victims hadn't come from poor homes and likely hadn't been homeless, so to speak, as they were freshly showered, wore nice jewelry, had expensive dental work, and were well nourished. For investigators, their best bet at the time was to try and track the dental work, so they published dental x-rays, charting, and records from both victims in the Journal of the American Dental Association in hopes that some dentist might recognize his or her work. But unfortunately, that never came to be. I've read several reports that when printed, the x-rays were actually displayed in reverse, which may have also caused confusion for anyone who may have been able to recognize them originally. While the ADA has an extensive readership, it certainly doesn't encompass all operating dentists in the United States, let alone the world. And authorities were about to receive a tip which would lead them to trying to determine the possibility that one or both victims may have been visiting from another country. Following the autopsies and examinations, authorities moved the victims into a locked room adjacent to a local funeral home, according to the Greenville News. Each victim was placed in a casket with a transparent window in the lid so that anyone who sought to identify them could see them easily. The victims were kept there for 1 year, during which time more than 30 individuals came and attempted to identify them, but none were successful in doing so. For Sheriff Parnell, it was mind-boggling to not know who the victims were, and he considered it critical to the investigation, telling the Greenville News late that August, quote, "We're running down every tip we receive, but none of them have panned out so far. We need to have these bodies identified so we can get cracking on this case," end quote. Early on, investigators received several tips and pieces of information. One of the first witnesses they spoke to is a man who, in most articles, has been referred to as a hermit. Apparently, he was someone who was living out near this isolated location where the victims were found, and there are several different stories about him. In one story, this witness reported hearing the gunshots the morning the two were killed. In other versions, though, it's reported that the man witnessed both of the victims being forced from a vehicle just prior to being shot. In another version, he actually witnessed the shooting and the two were forced from a van or a car. Unfortunately, there isn't a ton of consistency with this man's story. Thankfully, though, he was not the only person to come forward. Several months into the investigation, a man named David Batson contacted Lieutenant James Gamble of the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, claiming that he recognized the male victim. According to an article in the National Post, Batson explained to Gamble that he and his wife worked for KOA, Campgrounds of America, located in Santee, South Carolina, approximately 51 miles to the south of where the victims were found. Batson claimed to have met the victims on two separate occasions, once when they were apparently making their way south towards Florida, and a second time when they were returning from Florida. According to Batson, he got to know the male victim well enough that they were friendly and spent some time together playing pool and just hanging out. Batson delivered a key piece of information which, while very intriguing, has also paved the way for a great deal of confusion and speculation. According to Batson, the man gave him his name as Jock. In the official report written by Gamble, he spells it that way, J-O-C-K, like an athlete, Jock. However, while further detailing their encounters, Batson claimed that the man told him he was from Canada, was the son of a prominent doctor, had gone to school to be a teacher against his parents' wishes, and this ultimately resulted in them disowning him. Because of the mention of Canada and the confusion that can revolve around Southern accents, some have argued that the name Jock might actually be the name Jacques, J-A-C-Q-U-E-S, possibly suggesting a French-Canadian connection there. What truly made this piece of information so compelling was the ring. If you'll recall, it had the initials J-P-F, which would certainly fit either the name Jock or Jacques. In fact, Batson claimed that Jacques tried to sell him that ring at one point in time. Curiously, Batson had very little, if any, information about the female victim, and according to the four-page report Gamble wrote after their call, there's nothing to suggest that he even knew her name or spoke with her. However, there was a notation that the female was referred to by Jacques as his girlfriend, and the two were spending their summer aimlessly traveling around the country. This was surprising as, for a long time after finding them, police entertained the possibility that the victims may have been siblings, though a DNA test done many years later would conclusively rule that out. Just as a note from this time forward, I'll be referring to the victims as Jacques and Jane Doe, as they have been referred to this way for several years now. In regard to the campground information, while it's fascinating and insightful, I should note this wasn't followed up on at the time. Reportedly, after receiving the call and taking notes, those notes were filed away. Deputy Coroner Verna Moore, who took the case on more than 10 years later, did her best to follow up on the report. Unfortunately, by that time, Batson had passed away, and the new owners of that particular campground area, who had once possessed detailed records of everyone who had stayed there, had lost those records in a house fire. Why that information wasn't followed up on sooner is just a mystery which doesn't seem to have an answer. Investigators then received a call from another witness. This man, a mechanic working in York, Nebraska, one of the cities which had a Grant's truck stop, reported to police that he recognized one of the victims. According to him, he had done some mechanic work on their vehicle, a van, And while he couldn't remember a great deal of information about Jacques or Jane, he didn't even recall their names, he did believe that their van had a license plate issued in the Pacific Northwest, either Washington or Oregon. Unfortunately, despite opening up the Pacific Northwest in addition to the Southeast, Midwest, and Canada as possible locations the duo had been in, there were no major developments. It's intriguing, though, that they may have had a van, and the hermit, in one of his various descriptions, talked about a van. While the mystery of who Jacques and Jane really were was being tracked down, as best it could be, the question of who killed them and why was a separate but equal part of the investigation. Initially, it was believed that by identifying the victims, they might be able to determine a link. However, as time went on and it became more apparent that they were travelers with no solid ties to the area, the identity of the killer would become more elusive, or so investigators imagined. However, not long after the bodies had been found, police in the South Carolina town of Lotta had a major piece of evidence fall right into their lap during a routine traffic stop. The town of Lotta sits approximately 47 miles to the northeast of where Jacques and Jane were killed. After witnessing a vehicle driving erratically, local police executed a stop and the vehicle pulled to the side of the road. Upon approaching and speaking with the driver, it was determined that he was driving while intoxicated, and he was cuffed and placed in the back of a squad car. Following the arrest, officers executed a search of the vehicle, at which time they recovered a .357 revolver. The revolver's serial number was partially obscured, showing signs that someone had attempted to file it off. The man behind the wheel and then in custody was 58-year-old Lonnie George Henry of Wadesboro, North Carolina, some 60 miles to the northwest. The gun was taken into possession, at which time it was sent to the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division for processing. Ballistic tests would later confirm that Henry's gun was in fact the murder weapon used to kill Jacques and Jane. During questioning from law enforcement about the murders, Henry agreed to take a polygraph test. According to the results, Henry had passed when asked whether or not he had murdered the two, saying that he did not. Other polygraphs followed, and police later hinted that there had been signs of deception from Henry, not in regard to the murder itself per se, but about how long he had been in possession of the gun and whether or not the gun itself had been used in the murders. Apparently, Henry told investigators he had purchased the gun from a truck driver and only days later noticed that the serial number had been filed off, but when he tried to track down the man he bought it from, he couldn't find him. However, police were able to track the gun as the serial number was not completely filed off. According to their search, the gun had belonged to Henry's brother. When investigators approached and questioned him about the gun, he said that he had given it to Henry as a Christmas present 4 or 5 years earlier, and at the time he gifted it, the serial number had not been tampered with. Now, this gun's history is somewhat confusing, as the year given for Henry receiving the gun is 1972. However, news reports from 1977 say that the gun had been stolen in a robbery in Durham, North Carolina, in 1974. Perhaps it's bad reporting or a confusion of the timeline, but it's been confirmed that the gun had been part of a theft at some point in time. How Henry's brother got his hand on it has never been answered, but he did tell authorities he is certain he gave it to his brother as a gift. When confronted with that information regarding the gun's history, Henry apparently gave up under the pressure and told investigators that he had, in fact, been the one who tried to file the serial number off. Henry looked like a good suspect for the crime, so police began questioning him about his whereabouts on the night of August 8th and the early morning of August 9th. According to Henry, he was in Monroe, North Carolina, at his wife's side as she was in the hospital. Family members, when questioned, told investigators that Henry had in fact been there on the morning of the 9th. The hospital was approximately 96 miles north of where Jacques and Jane were found. By today's maps, that's a 1 hour and 50 minute drive. In order to verify his alibi, investigators made the drive there and back and ultimately came to the conclusion that Henry would have been unable to drive to Sumter County, commit the murders, and return to the hospital in a time which would make him the likely killer. Of course, I don't know exactly how they cross-reference this, We know the victims were found at 6:20 a.m. We know the so-called hermit reported hearing the shots that morning, but I've never found anything which states a specific time Henry was confirmed to have been at the hospital, nor an exact time when they believe the murders themselves actually took place. Surprisingly, not much came out of this. Police located the murder weapon, but lacked the evidence to actually put it in Henry's hands at the time the murders were committed. The sheer fact that he was driving around with it months after the murder raised several questions. Had he committed the murders and kept the gun? Had he loaned the gun to someone who committed the murders without his knowledge? Or had someone taken the gun without his knowledge and returned it? None of these questions have ever been given answers. Henry was looked into, certainly, and police found a line of tragic moments in his life. 3 years prior, Henry's son Charlie had died in a fishing accident when his boat capsized. Henry himself had been involved in an accidental death at his job when he killed a coworker by accidentally backing over him with a dump truck. Henry was notoriously known as having a drinking problem, and he had several run-ins with the law, though not for murder. This caused some to wonder if Henry could have committed the murders and not even remember doing it due to possibly having been drunk at the time. I do think it's interesting to note that Henry has been listed as being a truck driver by occupation, and the bodies were originally found by a truck driver. This has made some people wonder if that particular location, Locklear Road, was known by truckers in the area as the kind of place where certain illicit activities were able to take place without anyone noticing. As far as can be ascertained, Henry was the only person in this case who was truly dug into as a potential suspect, and for good reason. The fact that he had the murder weapon is a detail few can ignore, and for the most part, people tend to believe that if Henry himself was not the killer, he likely knew who the killer was. Whatever information Henry may have had with him, though, he took to his grave, passing away at the age of 63 in May of 1982, 6 years after the murders. For many, Henry is the prime and only suspect. Several sources I spoke with who have worked on this case under different professional offices have told me they firmly believe that Henry was involved in the murders and they don't think any other suspect is likely. Law enforcement kept the remains of Jacques and Jane in that room beside the funeral home for a year after their murders, hoping that someone could identify them. However, in August of 1977, a funeral was held and both were buried in Bethel United Methodist Cemetery in Oswego, South Carolina. At the time, their headstones were simply engraved as unknown male and unknown female. The funeral saw more than 200 mourners, with Sumter County Sheriff's deputies acting as pallbearers. It was a shock to everyone involved in this case that Jacques and Jane had not yet been identified. It was believed then, as it is today, that they had come from an upper-middle-class family background, and these people were likely to have missed them. However, over the span of the past 44 years, no one has yet come forward to claim them. Whether this is due to a lack of knowledge of their deaths in the case or some other reason, no one knows for sure. 30 years passed, and then in June of 2007, both bodies were exhumed to be sampled for DNA testing. This was when the tests were run, which confirmed that the victims were not related, not brother and sister, as many had presumed. However, with that DNA on file, there were no new developments, and despite renewed efforts over the years, their identities remain unknown. According to their entries on NamUs, there have been very few tests conducted. Jane has been tested twice and Jacques once, but there has never been a match. However, we may be on the brink of new information. In the summer of 2019, the DNA Doe Project got involved. In late July, they announced that they were beginning testing in hopes of determining their identities through the use of GED match. The project was fully funded by donations, and today their status is listed as undergoing testing. It's the best chance available to find their identities and return their true names, to find who they are, where they're from, and maybe to contact remaining relatives who may have been searching for them for more than 40 years. Jacques and Jane Doe were murdered on August 9, 1976 in Sumter County, South Carolina. For 44 years, they've remained unidentified, buried beneath anonymous markers. For investigators, many of the originals who took this case to their grave It's a question that needs answering. It became personal. They became desperate to find those answers, to serve justice, and yet neither of those things has happened. The murder weapon was found, but evidence couldn't be gathered to pin the crime to any one person. And while technologies have since advanced, the prime suspect himself is gone and can no longer be brought before a judge. For many, the mystery of their deaths remains haunting and poses questions that demand answers. But for others, it is the mystery of their lives that carries more value now, and those answers may be found sooner than later. Taking care of yourself is extremely important, and it doesn't have to be difficult either. With CBD, you can feel better without needing to rearrange your whole life. CBD helps me feel more rested, calm, and my body feels a lot less sore, which is a grateful break of pace at this time in my life. Now, I'm not talking about that gross-tasting juice that you drink out of a weird dropper that's impossible to get an accurate dose from. I'm talking about Caliper, a better way to consume CBD. Unlike CBD oils, Caliper CBD powder is tasteless and blends easily into any food or drink without a nasty aftertaste. That's exactly 20 milligrams in each package, taking all the guesswork away. I add Caliper to my morning coffee, and it's a great way for me to start my day. With Caliper CBD powder, you're clinically proven to absorb 450% more CBD compared to tinctures. That's pretty crazy. And Caliper gives you all the benefits of CBD in just 15 minutes, about twice as fast as CBD oil. Caliper comes in both 10 and 30 count packs, and best of all, you can get started for less than $20. Caliper has a special offer for all Trace Evidence listeners. Get 20% off your first order when you use the promo code TRACE at trycaliper.com/trace. You can try Caliper CBD risk-free for 30 days. If you don't love it, they'll give you a full refund, but you're gonna love it. That's trycaliper.com/trace. Don't forget to use promo code TRACE for 20% off your first order today. It's difficult to know how to approach cases involving unidentified victims. I've done a handful of Doe episodes in the past, and each time they're disturbing and haunting and upsetting. However, in almost all of the cases I've done, there's a very limited amount of information regarding the victims, and even less regarding a potential suspect. In the case of Jacques and Jane Doe, it's somewhat the opposite. There's a lot of information and possibilities when it comes to the victims. There's a very clear indication of a suspect and the murder weapon was recovered. However, nothing seems to come out of any of it, and depending where you look, you could find a wide assortment of theories and presumptions as to why. Ultimately, we have to try and look at things through the lens of facts, only by way of what can be proven, while looking at the theories from a basis of logic and reason. Speculation about this case is rampant. There's theories everywhere you look. I've read some crazy stuff during the research process, from people believing the victims were connected to organized crime to famous serial killers having been responsible. I've even come across a few examples where the correct pronunciation of the name Jacques is made much more difficult than it actually is. If there is a problem with this case, unlike Doe cases with limited information, it may be an embarrassment of riches, for lack of a better term. There may be too much to sift through, and while an absence of evidence provides a frustrating lack of direction, an overabundance of possibilities can stretch an investigator to their very limits, sending them backward through each step to determine where they made a wrong turn. And the more information they have that can't be verified, the more wrong turns can be made. Probably, the best way to begin looking at the theories in regard to this case is to begin with Jacques and Jane, because ultimately the question we're trying to answer is, how did they end up in the company of the person who killed them, and subsequently, why were they killed? Clearly, in this case, those aren't easy questions to ask, but there's some groundwork which has been done that can give us at least the ability to take a look around and see what's there. There's a lot of debate about where the victims come from. We have the statement from David Batson that Jacques, or Jock, depending on what you believe, claimed to have been from Canada. Reportedly, he was the son of a physician and had been disowned by his family for choosing to go down a different route, pursuing education instead of medicine. There's really nothing in that story which throws up a red flag. The guy has a dispute with his family, sets off for a journey of exploration in the late 1970s. It's happened a million times before, it'll probably happen a million times after. Assuming that he did originate in Canada, then some of the trail we've laid out by witnesses makes sense. Driving a vehicle with plates from the Pacific Northwest, heading down into areas such as Arizona, Idaho, and Nebraska, making your way east across the country, heading south, passing through Santee, South Carolina, some areas of Florida where he may have attended the races in Sebring, or met someone who had, and then back up into South Carolina, where ultimately he and Jane become the victims of a double homicide. This is all assuming that the witnesses' sightings are correct, and while it kind of fits together, it's also well established that eyewitnesses are usually terrible in terms of accuracy. Beginning in Nebraska, you have a mechanic who says he worked on a van and he believes Jacques and Jane were the ones who owned it. He could be right, but we don't have enough information to thoroughly analyze that. We don't know what exactly he told investigators, how he described them. Did he say he knew it was them, or that the pictures looked familiar? We don't know when he would have worked on their vehicle, any conversations they might have had. Hell, we don't know what was wrong with the vehicle. That doesn't mean he's wrong, but to believe it's completely accurate without any mistakes or the possibility of misidentification puts you in a tough spot. If he's right, you're going in the correct direction. But if he's wrong, you're looking in a region of the country where neither of these people may have ever been. But we may have details to verify this claim. The matchbook from Grant's truck stop. There was a Grant's in York, Nebraska, the same town where the mechanic worked. For many, that's enough to believe the story, and it's hard to blame them. It could be the first major clue in the case, and at least it brings you closest to where Jacques and Jane's trip originated. You go a little further south, you're in areas like Arizona, New Mexico, places where it's believed that Jane's jewelry was manufactured. It's hard to argue against, so it's surely possible that their journey could have begun in the Northwest, and it's not hard to imagine that they could have swung in from Canada. The next sighting happens in Santee. I've got no date ranges for this, and for whatever reason, the information as delivered to the officer who took the call got put in a box, and no one knew it was there for years. I still don't understand why. It's not like you could have forgotten. It seemed like a case of several possibilities. Either the officer didn't buy the story, so he didn't pass it along, or he did try to pass it along and no one believed him, or it just goes to a lack of interdepartmental cooperation that was common in that era. Maybe it's just for a reason we're never going to know. So David Batson tells investigators that he met Jacques and Jane, that they were at a campground in Santee twice, and he became friendly with Jacques. We still don't know the story with the spelling of the name, whether Batson specifically spelled it out as J-O-C-K, or if the investigator heard Jacques but wrote Jock. Either way, this is where a lot of the background on the victims come in. Canada, teacher, ring with his initials. I've always found it strange that this witness seemingly knew nothing about Jane. No mention of a name, no mention of anything really other than her being there. Seems strange to me that you become friends with a guy, enough so that you play pool with him and remember him when he passes through again, but you don't know the name of his traveling companion and apparently you didn't have any conversations with her, at least none that you reported or none that were put into the report. It's through this story, though, that you get the Florida connection. Batson tells the investigator that Jacques and Jane stopped in Santee on their way to Florida and then again on their way out. This seems to suggest they had to be headed down to Florida from a northern direction, and when their bodies were found, they're heading north of Santee, so it becomes a question of where they were coming from and where they were going. Florida is primarily hinging on two details, Batson's story and the shirt that Jacques was wearing at the time of his death. Of course, he's wearing a shirt from the 1975 race, not the 76 one which took place several months before his death. Could he have been at that race? Could he have picked up the shirt at a thrift shop, or could someone have just given it to him along the way? We don't know, but we'll get into their clothes a little bit later. We don't have any reported sightings of them north of South Carolina, but that doesn't mean they hadn't been there. If you're traveling through the United States and you're on the East Coast, I find it hard to imagine it doesn't occur to you at some point to go see New York, but maybe that's my bias as a former New Yorker. If you've never been to the US, what three cities would you visit? I feel like New York's going to be on most people's lists. That being said, New York State shares a border with Canada. It's not impossible to imagine they could have come down into the country through there rather than in the Pacific Northwest, depending on whether or not the mechanic was accurate. Then again, maybe you come in New York, head west, then go south, then back east, and make your way back north, just a big circle around the country. It's really impossible to say, but it does open the door to a lot of possibilities. There's 11.9 million residents of Canada who identify as French-Canadian, which many people believe Jacques may have been. And the majority live in the area of Quebec, though charts show that they're fairly widespread out across the entire country. It's only 46 miles from the heart of Montreal to the New York border. A lot of this, though, revolves around Batson's report, but in reality, even if Jacques was Canadian, he could have come from anywhere. Jane is harder to pinpoint. I do find it interesting that when they were found for years after, the resemblance between the two of them was so close it was considered they could be siblings. This could suggest they originated from the same area, or maybe it doesn't. On the Doe Network, interestingly enough, there's one note that Jane could possibly be of Middle Eastern descent. I'd like to give you more details on why, but there are no details listed. I've seen in some places, though, discussion revolving around the possibility that one or both of them could have come to the U.S. by way of Canada, but could have been born abroad somewhere else, moving to Canada at different points in their life. Ultimately, it's a wild goose chase trying to track down where they're from, where they traveled, where they were going, and where they had set as their ultimate destination. It makes more sense to me to look at what we do know. When they're found, they had no identification and no money, no vehicle. However, they were reported as being well-nourished, clean-cut, and freshly showered. Their clothes were clean, which seems to suggest that they weren't traveling in just one outfit. Everything to me screams that these two had money with them and likely a vehicle. They had a way of getting around without being completely dirty. They had changes of clothes. They had a way of cleaning their clothes. I've always wondered if investigators checked local laundromats for clothes that might have been left behind, but it's also possible they could have been in their car if they had one, and that was taken by the killer. They wore nice jewelry, expensive watch, nice rings. They don't necessarily fit the profile of two people wandering the country with just the clothes on their backs and no access to money. They both have dental work. Jacques has scars, including a surgical one. Jane has her ears pierced, her hair is well kept, her skin is well taken care of, and outside of unshaven legs, little which raises anyone's curiosities about the conditions in which she may have been living. Frankly, I've seen a lot of debate about her legs, and I don't think it's necessarily a super important detail. We don't know if it was that she hadn't shaved her legs for a few days or a few weeks, and without that information, it's really hard to lend an opinion. What I do find fascinating is that neither was wearing underwear and they both had on jeans, and that's not really a comfortable combination. However, we're talking about two teenagers who may have had a van or a car. It's not impossible to imagine they could have been sleeping or something else when the killer came upon them. Maybe they parked in a nice secluded spot. Maybe someone in that area saw an easy mark for robbery or murder. Of course, had it been a robbery, you'd imagine the killer would have taken the watch and jewelry, but you really never know what kind of person you could be dealing with here. Maybe someone in town saw them. Maybe they flashed some cash when they were buying food. Maybe they were a bit naive. Someone offered them a place to stay or take a shower, and it was all part of an elaborate plan to commit a horrifying double murder. When it comes down to the reasons for the killings, police only ever developed two prime theories, that Jacques and Jane had been hitchhiking and were either picked up by the wrong person, or perhaps they saw someone hitchhiking and picked him up. Either way, it could work, but there's a lot in between. Maybe they were hanging around town and befriended the wrong person. Maybe someone hit on one of them and it was supposed to be a fun night and things went bad for another reason. Honestly, the murders are what seems to provide the most confusing questions. If you're planning to kill them, why don't you rob them? Was murder always the plan? And if it was, why do it in that way? Bringing them to a desolate stretch of road, three shots fired from a .357 into each of them, two in the chest, one in the throat. I should note here, I've read some accounts that each may have been shot in the back first, then subsequently rolled over and shot two more times. That would certainly tell a different story in terms of the state of mind of the killer. However, something's always bothered me about this crime scene. How are they both found within feet of each other on their backs? Assuming the hermit's story is true, the two are forced out of the vehicle. The shots are fired from feet away. When one shot goes off, surely the other person's going to try to run or move or something. We have no indication that they were restrained in any way. Maybe the killer just shot one and then the other in rapid succession, but it's always bothered me. I suppose shock could factor in as well. To me, the location of the murders is one of the most valuable clues available. This isn't a road that's going to be traveled a lot. It doesn't really lead anywhere, especially in 1976. It's a pass-through that runs parallel to the interstate, and it's dirt. What I do find fascinating is that the man who finds them is a trucker, and the man who owns the murder weapon is a trucker. I just can't help but wonder if that particular stretch of road was an area known to locals as an isolated location where someone could do something and no one's going to notice. Police originally theorized that the killer had taken the victims down into that area to kill them in a wooded area, but found high fences blocking access, and so he shot them on the side of the road. I haven't been able to find any pictures of that road outside of the crime scene photos from that period of time, but where the victims were shot is just off the side of the road near a thicket of pine trees. Surely they could have marched into those woods first and maybe delay how long it would take for them to be found. So why not do that? It just seems unlikely to me that the killer happened to be going down I-95, took the exit and just noticed a dirt road there and thought it was a likely spot. I'm of the belief that this was someone who specifically knew that road was there. I've looked at the maps of the area a lot. Woods Bay State Park was just 6 miles away and had opened 3 years earlier. We know Jacques and Jane stayed at campgrounds before, so it's not impossible to imagine they could have been staying at the park that night when they met their assailant. They're in a car or a van. Maybe they're asleep. It's a hot South Carolina night, so they're not wearing much. Someone bangs on the vehicle and yells out, "Park police," so they throw their clothes on. Jacques doesn't even have time to put his shoes on. He gets out, and there's a gun pointed at him. It's not an impossible scenario. Then again, while Jacques wasn't wearing his shoes, Jane was wearing her wedges, which I've always found confusing. Maybe she hadn't taken them off yet and the killer was watching and saw that Jacques had undressed. Or maybe Jacques was falling asleep, got undressed to lay down, but she was not yet falling asleep. Either way, it's always been confusing to me that Jacques has no shoes on, but Jane does. There's a truck stop, one exit north on the interstate, certainly a likely place to come across a trucker who could be aware of Locklear Road. There's some lakes in the area, bigger ones out further, good places to dispose of a stolen vehicle. Then again, if no one knows the victims had a vehicle, then you have even less to worry about, and in the 1970s it wasn't all that difficult to steal a vehicle and get away with it. I suppose the question that's eating me here is, why kill them in the first place? If you're stealing their vehicle and leaving them in a desolate location, one you specifically chose, how much fear do you really have of being caught? You could be hours away by the time they tell police about the experience. I suppose maybe you don't live hours away, so you're likely going to get caught. Maybe there's something distinctive about you. Maybe there's something they could tell police which you believe will easily identify you. Maybe you're already known to the police. Looking at the murder scene, there's just so many questions. Why the three shots and why do the same places on both of them? The only logical reason for shooting each of them three times with a .357 from a few feet away is because you want to make sure they're dead. Now, whether that's because you don't want to be identified or because you enjoy killing or some other reason, I couldn't say. However, the shooting itself is curious. If you really want to make sure they're dead, why bother with one to the chest and one to the throat and another to the chest? Why not just go for the head? A .357 isn't going to leave a lot behind. You're going to know they're dead. It's also going to be even harder to identify them that way. I think it's unlikely the killer knew that Jacques and Jane would remain unidentified for this long. So, was it a matter of wanting to watch them die, of wanting to torture them, of wanting them to suffer for a few minutes, or of wanting them to look at you while they died? Or was it just habit? Was it something that the killer had done before and knew it worked, so why break the pattern? I haven't found any similar crimes that match these, but that doesn't mean the killer didn't have some knowledge, and if the killer possibly was a trucker, he could have lived in another area and simply knew about this location. We also have to remember it's 1976 and we could be looking at a veteran, someone who has killed before. Within the last 20 years, you've got World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. It's all speculation at this point, but I can't help wondering why it was done this way. Maybe you shoot them at the scene because you don't want to have to drag the bodies around. Maybe you don't shoot them somewhere else because you're not comfortable enough in that location when you first find them. There's no way to talk about the killing without addressing Lonnie George Henry, though. You've got a man notorious for having a drinking problem and getting in trouble with the law. He's found in possession of the murder weapon, lies about where he got it, and lies about filing down the serial number. It seems like he had a reason to want to distance himself from the gun, so why is he driving around with it under the seat of a car? Is it a matter of being so disorganized as a drinker or so messed up that he doesn't think ahead? If that's the case, then why do the murders feel so organized? This didn't seem to be a case of killing in the moment. He knew the location, he had the gun, it feels premeditated. But then you've got a very disorganized guy with a murder weapon. Some of these are a few of the reasons people argue that while Henry may not have been the killer, he may have known who the killer was. It seems outlandish, but maybe someone borrowed his gun. Maybe somebody took it without him knowing and then returned it, though if that were the case, it seems unlikely he'd be compelled to try and file down the serial number. Most evidence seems to indicate there was something about that gun he was trying to hide, just not something strong enough to make him consider actually getting rid of it. I have from time to time considered the possibility that friends likely knew he kept the gun under the seat of his car. It would certainly be an easy grab when he's gone to bend or is out for the night on a bender. Does he get suspicious that the gun was used in the killings and it scares him? Does he know the gun was stolen at some point, so he tries to file the numbers down? It's extremely difficult to accept that the man in possession of that gun is not the man who pulled the trigger. What are the chances? Did someone use the gun, reload it, and put it back without being noticed? Did Henry see the news reports and then remember that a friend or family member had borrowed the gun and he got worried? Again, if so, why keep it? Throw it in a lake, throw it in a river, you have a lot of options. Some people have argued that Henry knew the killer and was trying to protect them, but again, that makes me circle back to why did he keep the gun? It just doesn't make any sense. The sad truth of Henry is that he was cleared because of his alibi. Witnesses saw him at the hospital, and police didn't think it fit the time frame for him having been able to pull off the murders and be back at the hospital when witnesses said he was there. I'm sure they know more about this situation than we do, but if they believed Henry hadn't been the killer, they must have looked at other people he knew. There must have been someone that raised a few eyebrows. I find it hard to believe that they would just dismiss this whole angle, but I can't say for sure one way or another what they truly think about Henry. Looking at the facts, there's only so much you can say. The killer knew where the road was. The killer had access to a gun that belonged to a man who lived one state over. The killer was able to execute the murders without getting caught in a location where he knew no one was likely to be. He didn't rob his victims, but he ensured they were dead. Was this really, at the end of all things, a case of someone looking to steal a car and killing for it? Was it a hitchhiker or someone who caught a ride with Jacques and Jane and something went wrong and he decided to kill? Was it a case of someone walking around with a loaded .357 who really wanted to use it? They're all tough questions, and unfortunately, none of them have answers. 44 years ago, Jacques and Jane Doe were murdered in cold blood. They were left on the side of a dirt road next to an interstate, and ever since, investigators have tried to determine who they are, what brought them there, why and by who they were killed. Nearly 5 decades later, and none of those questions have been answered, at least not certainly. Lonnie George Henry is considered the killer by most people who look into this case, while the majority of the rest believe if he wasn't the killer, he probably knew who was. Sadly, though, we have none of these answers. Sadly, those who may have had these answers back in 76 may be dead by now. The families left behind by the victims could be gone, but for younger siblings or perhaps parents who have lived to a ripe old age. While we may never know the truth about the murders, we do yet have the opportunity to discover the truth about Jacques and Jane. As you listen to this, though, the DNA Doe Project is working to try and track down their familial connections through DNA analysis, maybe radioisotope testing to try and determine where they may have grown up. Perhaps sooner than later, we'll have some answers, and if we do, Jacques and Jane's names may be restored to them. If that happens, then what will be left is the question of who killed them and why. That question, though, may prove to be far more elusive than the 44-year-old mystery of their true identities. If you're looking for more information about the murders of Jacques and Jane Doe, the Sumter County Does, there are many articles and forums discussing their case. Robin Warder of The Trail Went Cold did an episode discussing them. Unsolved Mysteries also ran a short segment on them. You can look them up on the Doe Network as well as on Namus. Jacques can be found under UP13772 and Jane under UP13773. If you have any information about the murders of Jacques and Jane Doe, please contact the Sumter County Sheriff's Office at 803-436-2790 or the Sumter County Coroner's Office at 803-436-2111. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. Should the DNA Doe Project release an update in this case, if their identities are revealed or any new information comes out, I'll certainly release an update episode addressing that new information. At this point, we can only hope that their identities will finally be revealed. I'd like to take a moment now to thank our amazing Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne M. Bertram, Astrid Maria Nyer, Brett Eady, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Emily Smith, Emma Vachon, Jessica Chagnon, Kevin Bonham, Megan Cotter, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah, Samantha Ford, Stephanie Eve, Stephen Weiland, Tara Doble, Tom Archer, Tracy Woods, and Travis Skepsko. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. That is going to wrap up episode 118. I want to thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.